Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. And today's guest is David Cereda, all the way from, are you in the US or Canada, David?
I'm in Canada now, my home country.
I wasn't too sure. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
Well, it's great to be here in Australia. I'm a big fan of a lot of the Jonathan Schiff productions. I don't know if you know his stuff. The H2O Just Add Water, The Elephant Princess, and there's a new one about surfer girls who are aliens. And I don't know if you've seen those, but those are Australian productions. Awesome. It's called Lightning Point. Have you seen Lightning Point?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
It's a great Australian production. It's these two girls come in a spaceship, and they want to learn how to surf. It's really great. My daughter loves it. And The Elephant Princess and the H2O Mermaid series are all Jonathan Schiff Australian productions, which are fantastic.
Can people find them on YouTube?
Oh, yeah. They're actually on Netflix. They're on iTunes. I mean, they're everywhere. They're very good productions.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, anybody listening or watching, go and check it out. Go and check it out. Now, I've got your website up also at the moment, davidcereda.net. You've got a lot going on the website, lots of different things which we will get into. Now, for those who don't know too much about you, you've done a few, well, not a few things, you've done a lot of things. You've done documentaries from Here to Andromeda. You've done UFOs Unplugged with Dan Aykroyd, amongst a lot of other things. You've gone into the propulsion side of things. You've been on lots of radio and TV shows and that sort of thing. So would you mind telling people how you got into all this? And I believe you had an experience in Berkeley, California, years ago, but seeing some type of very similar to a Billy Meyer type craft, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it all started for me. You know, growing up, I was born in Canada in 1961, and I have four brothers, and my dad was getting his PhD in psychology at Berkeley, so we all moved there. And growing up in California in the 60s was pretty radical because there were tear gas riots, you know, from the Vietnam protests. And I remember crawling around the Berkeley campus, and I could barely see anything because the tear gas was burning our eyes so intense. We were hiding underneath the benches from the police with my mom. It was like crawling around a war zone. I mean, I thought it was kind of neat as a kid, but I didn't really understand the full extent of what was going on, you know, police, you know, shooting these tear gas canisters. And I still remember the burning and how much it burned my eyes. And in those days, you know, parents let their kids walk home alone from school. And I went to this school called Cornell Elementary School, which is kitty corner to Berkeley and the Berkeley campus. And we lived in this little place called the University Village, which was for students. And I was seeing a pandemonium, people pointing up in the sky looking at a flying saucer. And because I built model airplanes and hot rod cars, you know, with the little Revel model kits, I was very familiar with different types of craft. And also I was a Star Trek fan. And so I could recognize the symbol. And I had seen a lot of Goodyear blimps. And this was nothing like that. This thing was shimmering. It looked like one of the crafts that Meyer later took pictures of in about 1972. He started taking those pictures. But this was 1968 when this happened. And then in the fall, you know, we watched it for about 20 minutes and it just shimmered. It didn't accelerate like you would see in a lot of the fake YouTube videos. It just kind of started shimmering and then it was gone. But it was metallic, you know, like a perfect lens shape. And there were no markings, no rivets. I mean, the cleanest metal, probably the color of tungsten for people who know their metals. And then it just blinked out and it was gone. And, you know, I walked home. And right at that period, that exact period, my mom was in the middle of divorcing my dad because the 60s were too wild for her. And my dad was into a lot of the 60s movement. And she married a science teacher named David Cooper and moved us up into the Berkeley Hills in this new house. And it was in that house that within days I began having contacts with them. And they don't use the word Pleiades, but they showed me their star system being what we call Pleiades. And they showed me the inside of their craft and how they worked. and the counter rotating clockwise, counterclockwise spinning lights. And they were completely human, very tall, and very kind. And I remember this one experience one night where I was paralyzed. My body went into what's known as sleep paralysis, and I couldn't get back in my body. And I was with them for a long time, and we had a babysitter. And I finally got into my body and let out the most piercing scream, and she came running down the stairs like, "What's wrong?" And these contacts went on. They went on for probably in the order of a month. And that was, you know, in those days, you know, I could tell my mom, I could tell my stepfather, because I didn't see my real father much anymore at that time. And there was nobody to talk to. They didn't understand what was going on. They didn't know what flying saucers were. And so I just kind of kept it to myself my whole life. And until my mom sent us back to live with our real dad in late of 1972 in Vancouver, Canada. And on the news, it was on a TV channel there that was the Billy Meyer case. And they were showing photos of the UFOs. And I went, "Oh my God, that's what I saw." You know, so you're talking about 1968 to, you know, 1973-ish, not very much longer. And Meyer had just started taking the pictures in 72. He claimed that he was having experiences with Palladians when he was a kid, but he didn't take any photos. Now, I was, when, you know, my stepfather, David Cooper, actually was not a science teacher yet. He was working as a photo clerk at a drugstore while he was going to school, and he was just right out of the Army. And he was developing film all the time and got me into taking pictures, but that would have been later than the time of my sighting and my experience. And then my whole life goes by, and, you know, it wasn't, you know, jumping way ahead until I figured out a technology to contact Palladians, because I realized that, you know, we're beings of frequency. See, we're actually, if you measure the five human brainwave states from deep delta, which are really low frequency brainwave states, which most humans experience in deep, deep dreamless sleep, then you go to theta brainwaves, which is where we dream, we lucid dream, and then you go from there to the active state of alpha, you know, and the beta states and the gamma states. So you have five brainwave states. Now, the way you calculate the frequency of Earth that Tesla and Schumann discovered is, you see, the way planets generate their frequencies is that you get, because of a lot of lightning strikes, but not just lightning strikes, a lot of electromagnetism coming from the sun and in the cosmos, it excites the electrons in the crust of the Earth and the core, and then it also excites electrons in the gas, you know, oxygen, nitrogen envelope around it. And electrons, when they're excited, which they are almost all the time, they eventually, they go get into some pretty high velocities, but they don't approach the speed of light. And then right above the envelope of the electron movement in the conductive part of the Earth's crust and its atmosphere, you get an electromagnetic signal. An electromagnetic signal is basically the speed of light, because all electromagnetism oscillates at the speed of light. So to calculate the frequency of Earth, you just take the distance around the Earth at the equator, and you take the speed of light divided by that. It's a very simple math. And it was known for a long time that Tesla knew the frequency of the Earth. And I was always curious that the frequency for Earth, 7.83 hertz, which is only one band of Earth frequency, because the frequency changes the higher up you go or on the sphere, right? So the frequency is really low at the equator, it's actually 7.4, 5 something at the equator. And then when you get up higher and higher, the frequency gets higher because the wavelength or the distance around the Earth is smaller. And I said, we dream at that frequency. This cannot be a coincidence that we dream in theta and Earth is in theta. So I wanted to find out, what are the frequencies of the nine planets? And when NASA had absolutely flawless data on the circumference and the radius of the nine planets, so when I calculated their frequencies, I went, wait a minute, those are all human brainwave states. And it makes sense that our brains are producing the wave states that we go into from alpha to, you know, from delta to gamma. See, all our brainwave states are happening all at the same time, but certain brainwaves become more pronounced at different times of the day and different functions. The nine planets are so close to us, at the speed of light, they're only minutes away from us. So essentially what happens is they electrically transfer their frequencies to us, right? In the same way, when you're barefoot on the earth, you feel very relaxed because the frequency of earth is very relaxing. It's actually upper theta. It's between alpha and theta, which is waking, but really relaxed.
Healing as well.
And very healing. So what I'm saying is I realized, oh my God, our brains are receiving the frequencies of the nine planets. And because every planet is a different size, they're all different, sending out different frequencies. So it means we're tuned to those frequencies. And we dream at the frequency of our own earth, and we collectively dream together. And what interested me the most, because I wanted to make quantum faster than light contact with distant star systems, is NASA knew the radius of dozens and dozens of stars. And if you know the radius, you know how to calculate the frequency of the planet, of the stars. So NASA knew the radius of five Palladian stars, and I said, I can do all their frequencies, and they're all super deep deltas. And then I can scale them because they're stars. They naturally scale into higher frequencies up the sphere. And so I started developing a technology to send them messages. And this happened in the year, I started this work in 2009 and 10. And I sent out a message through a transmitter. And I asked them the question, basically, I sent them my wife singing a jazz song, Fly Me to the Moon, you know, Frank Sinatra's jazz song. And my wife was training to be a jazz singer in Los Angeles. She had this beautiful voice. And I said, I'll just kind of do this as a joke. I'll send my wife's jazz song to the Pleiades and see what happens. And that night, we were living in Sedona, Arizona at the time. And my daughter was not yet born. And I hear this voice. I mean, I'm sleeping, and I hear this very calm, super mellow male voice saying, we received your message. Now, what would you – congratulations, they said. We received your message. Now, what do you want to ask us? And I leaped out of bed. This was audible. It wasn't like you would hear your brain talking to itself, like its own thought process. This was actually an audible voice.
I'll ask you a question because those who know my story and that, I've had experiences with Pleiadians. I actually wrote the Book of Shiji, which is a being from the star Merope, not a planet, an actual star in the Pleiades. When I first started having contact with her, and I've only found it out from a few people, she had an aura. Now, she's a light being, but she appeared as physical, as a human, bigger eyes.
Bigger eyes, yeah.
Yeah. Now, when she first... Sorry, mate. Go on.
The ones I saw didn't have any whites in their eyes. These women had just very deep indigo eyes, but there's no whites. But they're very human.
When the communication came to you, was it almost like as if they were speaking through a microphone and this and the speaker was in the middle of your head vibrating out?
Sure. I mean, that's a good way to describe it.
That's how I've described it. That's very interesting because we haven't spoken to it just now. So I just wanted to ask you that question because that's just some correlating stuff on another level there. But please continue.
Well, that's fantastic because, you know, the more people that have the same experience, then you start to go, wow, they really are there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Mayan calendar, the long count, it turns out I saw this amazing video on YouTube. Our solar system makes a complete revolution around Alcyon, the central star in Pleiades, every Mayan long count. And of course, the Mayans in Central America at Tikal, their pyramids are built in the ratio of Pleiades, and they say the Pleiadians actually built them. That's what the local, you know, Guatemalan Mayans say that happened. So what's happened is, see, the way radio communication works is, let's go back to how we're beings of frequency. You can see this on my website because we have all these crystal pendants that are tuned to different frequencies.
And there's a link just into the description part of this video or where you download the audio. Just go there, people, and the link's straight there to davidsarita.net. Continue, mate.
Yeah, so what you're realizing, the way radio works is any two quartz crystal oscillators, or actually any two oscillators of any means of creating frequencies, which you can do with a number of different ways, but today in most of our cell phone technology, we use quartz crystal oscillators to generate frequencies. So any two distant oscillators at the same frequency set up radio communication. And radio communication is the speed of light, which is very slow between here and Pleiades. But physicists have found, and Einstein was one of the first to find, a phenomenon known as action at a distance. And the action at a distance is a quantum function that is instantaneous, faster than light, regardless of the distance. So there's another function that we don't use with our technology inside of quantum communication. And plants have it. There's a biophysicist in Germany named Fritz Albert Popp who measured the speed of light coming off of human DNA, which is a coil, that it's faster than light. And in plants, it's faster than light. So what this means is, what I realized is if I pulse my body with these transmitters, which I have available on my website, if I pulse my body with Palladian frequencies, will I set up a faster than light communication with them? And that's what I found to be true over and over again. I had not had any contact with Palladius since I was a kid. I'm 54 years old today, and I started doing this in the year 1999 and 2000. I started making contact with Palladius this way. And they recognized me instantly and started teaching me so many things. They knew everything about my life. They knew when I asked them, like, why hadn't I seen them my whole life? They told me that they couldn't get their craft that close anymore. Because what I saw in Berkeley that day, the craft were incredibly close. And everybody's looking at them in very good fine detail. In fact, if I had binoculars, it would have been phenomenal detail because they were that close. And, you know, about as close as the Meyer photos. And so what they told me is that our military is so intimidating. As soon as they materialize, you see, they don't move through the fabric of space-time. That's not how they get here. It's kind of like two fish under the water, and you think of how fast they have to wag their tail to form propulsion to move across, let's say, from Australia to New York City. And, you know, it's going to take them a long time because water is very heavy. But if one of the fish gets out of the water, his buddy underwater, when he sees the other fish leaving the water, you'll see a bunch of wavy lines because he'll go to the surface, right, like a dolphin leaping out of the water. You can't see the dolphin beyond the surface of the water if you're underwater. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. You'll just see a little, you'll see a disturbance in the surface of the water. And I've done this, you know, I've looked at video footage of dolphins doing this. And when they enter the water, they suddenly just appear. Well, that's what these craft look like. They don't move through the fabric of space-time. They jump in and out of the space-time water. This is water. This is dense. I mean, I was a skydiver for about 15 years. I have 300 skydives. And one of my jumps was from 35,000 feet in Davis, California. I trained at Edwards Air Force Base to do high-altitude skydiving. And I couldn't believe that when I was doing about 300 miles an hour in the upper atmosphere, because it's very light. But as soon as you hit the lower atmosphere, it's like jumping into a lake. You know, suddenly, boom, the water hits you and throws your head back. And that's what it's like when you hit the lower atmosphere at 300 miles an hour. It's dense. So what we're inside of here is like liquid. We don't even realize it. Mm-hmm. So when we think of Einstein's problem, that the faster, for example, an aircraft goes, it encounters inertia mm-hmm. in the form of drag, which is the Air Force term for the air or the air mass pushing against the wing of the airplane. You can only go so fast before you heat up the aircraft because of the friction and the turbulence, right? So it's kind of the same for the two fish under the water. They can only go so fast, but if one of the fish hops out of the water, catches a Qantas airline and ends up in New York, his buddy's going to show up like a month later, right? So it's kind of like the ETs look at us like that. It's like you guys are trying to move spacecraft through the water, through the fabric of space-time, which is very dense stuff. And they figured out how to get out. And we keep trying to move through it, which is like a caveman banging his head against the wall. And, you know, we're talking about getting to Mars in a matter of months, you know, or years. I don't know how long. There's different propulsion ideas about going to Mars. And none of these ETs are doing this. They don't work like that. Only the ETs that are bound to the solar system that are probably using anything like that. But anybody in the cosmos who's figured this out, they don't use that kind of technology. So that's why what I witnessed is very pure. Now, when you watch good footage of UFOs, if it's real, you're going to see them jumping in and out. You're not going to see them. I mean, they have the ability to move around, and they can even land once they're here. But our military is so advanced now with radar that once they appear in our skies, this is what the Palladians told me, we haven't been able to appear to you because it's too dicey, dangerous, because, you know, our military is going to be there so fast and try to knock them out of the sky. They're not very militant. They don't really have an interest in weaponizing their craft. A lot of their scout craft are not weaponized. They're so fast that they could outrun any of us. So they're not really into that whole idea of conflict and battle. So they tend to appear in more remote places or less weaponized places where there's not a lot of radar. This is the conversation I ended up having. So what had happened is after my first experience, I decided to write a bunch of questions to the Pleiades. I recorded it in Pro Tools, and then I sent it out through my transmitters. I used 9 transmitters when I sent the, see, I can, there's two ways I communicate with Pleiades. One, another star system, is I can pulse my body with the frequencies and align my frequencies to theirs. So when any two frequencies are the same, you have communication. And with living systems, plants and humans and mammals like dolphins, you have a spiritual experience like you're describing, because you probably naturally tuned yourself to Pleiades somehow. Maybe because you are, maybe did you find out you were from there in previous lives, or
part of that? And then some, like, I've lived lives in Iran and Sirius and other places as well, and beyond the realms. But it's very interesting what you're saying, because if you look at even now with science, if you've got two particles have a symbiotic relationship, they don't even have to be near each other. So if this is what you're saying, that you hit yourself with the frequency and align it with what the frequency is where you're trying to communicate with, you're going to have automatically a symbiotic relationship through using consciousness, while hitting yourself with that frequency. Is that sort of... what you're saying?
That's dead on. I mean, see, the only difference between consciousness can travel faster than light. So Pleiades are over 440 light years away from Earth. And to communicate with them, you just need to know their frequencies. And then some people I've had do this. You know, it's kind of like you can't – with consciousness, if they don't like your vibration, they may not want to talk to you, or they may not be – you may feel the vibration of Pleiades, but you may not meet anybody from there if there's nobody there that's interested in you. It's kind of like an open phone call from Earth. And do they like this guy's or this woman's vibe or not? Or maybe that's not the right star system for that person. Like, I've done the frequencies for Sirius and Vega and Arcturus, because I've met Arcturians and I've had Palladians right in front of me with my eyes open. I've had Arcturians right in front of me with my eyes open. But there are certain star systems I can feel the energy of that star and get really high on it. Like, you get blissed out because your stars are actually producing bliss. They're true logos vibrations, right? Like, even Jesus in the gospel, you know, of John, it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." But that's a Greek manuscript. The original John is Greek. And in the Greek, it says, "In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God." But Logos goes back to ancient Egypt as the sound of the sun, meaning the vibration of our star. So God consciousness is coming from the stars. And because every star in the universe is a different size, they all have different frequencies, which is what sets them apart in their unique vibration. So when you experience the vibration of a star, it's kind of interesting. So if I was a Buddhist, which I was for many, many years practicing Buddhist meditation, I wouldn't really want to meet anybody from Pleiades. I would want to feel what it feels like to feel the bliss of the Pleiadian stars. And then eventually somebody might show up. But I'd be more interested in the vibe of those stars. And it's the same in, like, you know, the sound of one hand clapping or the mantra Om in the Vedas from ancient India. The actual mantra Om means the sound of the sun in the Vedas. That's what it actually means. So it's the same thing that Jesus is saying in John, that Logos is really the perfect vibration of your local star. And in the original Lord's Prayer in Aramaic, Jesus is actually saying, "O thou from whom the breath of life comes, who fills all realms with sound, light, and vibration." You see, sound, light, and vibration is Logos. It's the vibration. The sun is creating all these vibrations to sustain and give birth to all life and creating sacred geometries with all the spinning wavelets. So when you go and tune to a star like Vega, for example, the star in the movie Contact, the sound of Vega, when I scale Vega into our audible range, it's my favorite. You listen to Vega, you go to my website and listen to Vega. It is beautiful. It is a really nice sound. And the Pleiades, the individual stars are very nice, but when you blend all five together, it's a pretty intense vibration. So you can tune to one star in Pleiades, or you can tune to the whole thing. You have choices. So what I'm doing now is I'm opening what's called Project Astral Stargate. And what Project Astral Stargate is it's kind of like remote viewing with star frequencies. It's saying, let's take people and get them dedicated to a specific star system or star and spend a whole year meditating to those frequencies and logging their experiences. You can't jump around all over the place unless you're a really good meditator. If you're a good meditator, you'll know how to have an experience within a month with a star system. And you may only feel the vibration. There's three ways when you're tuning to a star system to get an experience. The first way, which is the least expensive way, is to just use headphones and use the scaled frequencies of that star system and do some breathing exercises before you meditate to that sound, and then go to sleep. And when you go to sleep, don't go back on the internet and get your mind involved in that, because you're going to be put back out of tune with that star. You're going to go right back into internet world. So you got to do it before you go to sleep. And the better way to do it is to use one of my mantra transmitters, because the mantra transmitters transmits the much lower frequency that you can't hear into your DNA. So your DNA is a coil, and a coil is an electrical inductor receiver transmitter. So if I take one coil and I run electricity through it, and I take another coil a few feet away from that one, the one a few feet away with no power will register voltage and current at a distance. And that's how your DNA receives frequencies. There's a scientist named Luc Montagnier who discovered the AIDS virus. He's a virologist, means he studies viruses. And he tested human DNA to see if it could read frequencies. He found it can read ultra-low frequencies, like the frequency of Earth. He tested 7 hertz on DNA and found DNA can read it no problem. So if DNA reads frequencies, and it's in the middle of all your cells, when you use a device like my mantra transmitters or my wands, which are crystal oscillator frequency transmitters, you store the frequencies in your iPad. It goes to a high quality tube amplifier which connects to the transmitter, then you're receiving inside of my file that's on the website there for Pleiades, for example, there's a blend of ultra-low frequencies, which are delta, and then it scales. I take those frequencies and I scale them all the way up to the audible range. So if you're using headphones, you're only getting a limited part of the frequencies is what I'm saying.
Right.
With sound, it's not as penetrating as a magnetic field. So if I'm transmitting frequencies through an inductor, sacred geometry inductor, your body is going to receive it on a way higher percentage level than with audio. And of course, with a magnetic transmitter, you can receive really low frequencies, even less than 1 hertz. And you can only generally hear 20 hertz and upwards to 20,000 if you have really good ears. So that's the second way, and that's the way I've had the most success. But I have had success with other people who just do the audio. There's some people who just download the audio frequencies on Project Actual Stargate on my website, and they'll tell me they had an amazing dream where they were shown a secret to propulsion or something the night they did the frequencies. And then there's people that will, as you're doing the frequencies, you'll start, if you focus on the third eye, between the space between the eyebrows, and you're not projecting, you're just in a gentle receiving mode, you might see them in your third eye. And the most advanced way to have an experience is have them appear holographically, fully visual to the open eyes, with your eyes open in the middle of the night. And that is my favorite way to receive contact, but it is the most rare. I've had them in my house with my eyes open many, many times, the Palladians.
That's been the situation with myself, and others have experienced that with me, which is why I've also been able to film the crafts as well and get photos of the crafts. One thing I wanted to ask you is, when I started to see another form of this same being, I started to appear on, it looked like a disc, but I was inside the craft and there was like five of us in a, basically sitting down with our legs crossed, almost in a meditative pose. We were white light beings with a tinge of blue to it, but so was the craft. There was no difference between the beings and the crafts, and we were light. And everything I knew, they knew, and I knew everything they knew. Though when you come back to the body computer, it's a different matter because of, you know, in that state, that you're unbounded.
It's incredible what you're saying, man, because one night we had done the Palladian frequencies in our bedroom in Sedona, and my wife and I both bolt out of bed at the same second, and at the foot of bed, I see these three Palladians with this pale blue light. They're totally human in shape, but I don't even see the eyes. And I see them with my eyes open. And my wife jumps up the same second, and she's seeing them too at the same exact second. And so it's the same color tone you're talking about.
It's beautiful.
One of them was like a pale yellow. And I was astounded. My heart's beating. I'm seeing this. My eyes are open. And my wife is up, and like we're like both looking. And I said, what did you see? You know, my wife's name is Crystal. And what she saw was a little stick man pedaling on a bicycle. And I said, oh, my God. Because she always told me, I don't want to see them the way you see them, David, because that would be too scary. I like to hear them, and I like to see them in my dreams, but I'd be too scared to see them. And I said, they let you see a stick man because it's like a kid, right? It's harmless.
That's what you can handle.
That's what you can handle.
Yeah.
They knew that about her. Like, that is just, it shows you how advanced they are not to scare her, you know? Actually, remember the movie Cocoon when they take off their skins and they just become pure light beings?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The movie, that's what they looked like. And there were like four of them. And then there was another time, I mean, I've seen them in the house, and then they started physically doing things in the house, which were really, really astounding things they were doing. And like one day I have the baby monitor on and I'm watching my baby and my wife asleep because my daughter was just a little infant, and I'm making borscht in the kitchen in Sedona, and all of a sudden the camera turns off and I go into the bedroom and there's a little switch on the monitor camera. It's an infrared camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it had physically been switched off. And my daughter and my wife were asleep. So I mean, they threw a physical switch. I mean, it's not like it just connected the circuit. The switch was actually in the off position to turn the monitor off. So things like that started happening in the house, really friendly little things like that. And I the full extent of my contacts, if people go to my website, there's an hour and a half MP3 audio there where they can listen to all my Palladian experiences. But so then, I started to go, wow, this is really amazing. They're telling me in great detail why they didn't appear to me my whole life. I figured out how to open a portal to make quantum contact happen. And then they started going into precise detail on the propulsion systems of the craft and how they work. And the Great Pyramid of Egypt, they showed me, this went, back to the year I turned 51. I'm 54, so that's 3 years ago. I was able to decode all the frequencies in the Great Pyramid, and they're showing me that those pyramids were giant crystal oscillators generating frequencies that opened up real portal stargates that could physically move persons, not just astral projection. That you could astral project and tune to a specific star group with a smaller device like the ones I have on my site. But the pyramids were much bigger than that because they opened physical stargates. So one night I'm in Sedona and I do the Pallades frequencies and I don't know who I'm going to meet. This really astounded me, but I meet Anubis in a dream. So a dream is also a lucid dream is a very valid way to make contact because we know that, I've been meditating every day for 35 years, and I can tell you that without frequencies, I can go into really high states of bliss and go to bed, and my dreams will be very abstract and very human. And some of them have been quite bizarre over the years, and a few times I've been to heaven on the on the causal plane. But the majority of dream time without using frequencies is nowhere near as eventful as it is with using these devices to help tune me to a star. So this night I do the Palladian frequencies, and I'm astounded who I'm meeting in the dream. It's Anubis. Anubis is the in Egyptology is the dog god. He's got the long, black
Yeah,
body.
we've got a statue of him here. My partner's actually had experiences with him as well. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Right. Now Anubis is a shapeshifter, so he's the son of Nephthys, which is Isis's sister. And he doesn't always appear that way, but he actually even showed me how it happened that he was able to shapeshift. So what Anubis shows me is that there was a disaster coming, and this was probably in the order of over 10,000 years ago, according to him. And it came on so suddenly, they didn't have the kind of satellite monitors that we have right now. But they had the technology to open up wormholes, and they can quantum leap anywhere they wanted within the local star groups. And so Anubis gets into the pyramid, he goes into the king's chamber, and there's a throne in there, and he sits down and he switches on some buttons, and he's got this beautiful dog collar. He's standing upright, but he is the head of a dog and the body of a human. And he's black and he has black fur on his arms, and he's talking to me and he's saying, we didn't know this was happening. And he switches the pyramid on, it starts forming these oscillations. It burns a hole in the sky right above the apex of the pyramid. It opens up a wormhole, and we're all taken. I went through the wormhole with Anubis and many others to another star system and another planet, which they had their oscillators tuned to the receiving point. He said, when we came back through the wormhole, the pyramid still worked, and everybody there worshiped us as gods. He said, we weren't gods, we were just very advanced beings. And we live much longer than humans. We don't die and age the way humans do. But he said, we are definitely not the gods of the universe. We're just a very, very advanced race. And the pyramids were still working for a long time until they were badly damaged. Well, by robbers and invaders, mostly Muslim robbers and invaders, after the 6th century AD were destroying the pyramids. But there was some damage done to them before that. And now this gets really interesting. This is where it gets astounding. See, when you calculate the frequencies of a crystal oscillator that size or any size, you take the dimensions of the crystal, or in this case, the pyramid has these three layers of semiconductive material. They have the radioactive granite, and it's quite radioactive granite, according to Robert Temple, who took measurements inside the pyramid with a Geiger counter. And then it has two different types of limestone casing around that. Now, when you make a crystal oscillator or a transistor, which amplify all the weak signals in your computers and produce all the colors and sounds and everything in your computer is done with crystal oscillators and transistors. So the way you make these things is you layer conductor and semiconductive materials, which is kind of how the pyramids are layered in the three different materials. And you do that to create an electrical difference, which allows electrons to move from one place to another. So the electrons get excited using a charge mechanism, which I believe is what the Ark of the Covenant was. It actually slid up and down the rollers, up and down the Grand Gallery, because wherever you move your charge, if you move it higher, you'll generate a higher frequency because the distance around the pyramid higher up is shorter distance. And if you move it down to the base of the pyramid, you have lower frequencies, which allows you to generate different frequencies inside of the pyramid, not just one frequency. But when I took measurements, really the accurate measurements of the capstone base of the Great Pyramid, and I converted, you see, they measure it in Egyptian inches and they measure it in cubits. So I took the Egyptian inch measurement, which is almost the same as our inch. It's 0.0016 or something different than ours. And I decided to resolve the speed of light in Egyptian inches because I wanted my resolution flawless. When you're gonna take the speed of light divided by the distance around the pyramid. So at the capstone base, it's 570 something primitive inches on each side. So you square that and then you change that into Egyptian inches and you take the speed of light in with 186,282 miles per second. And you convert that into inches and then convert it to Egyptian inches. So this is how accurate I did it. So I take the speed of light in Egyptian inches divided by the, you see, the electrons move inside of the stone at less than the speed of light. But just above the stone, you have an electromagnetic standing wave, oscillating standing wave, which would be a square wave. And you can get sine waves as well inside of the material. But I did the math, and the frequency came out to be 5.151 megahertz squared. So that's 5151. So it's 5,151,000 hertz, or 5.151 megahertz. Now, the slope angle of the pyramid is 51 degrees and 51 minutes. So you go, holy cow. Now, the speed of light, the builder would have had to know the speed of light more accurately than Einstein knew it, because we didn't have it accurate until after 1972. So when Einstein was making calculations, the speed of light was wrong.
He said it was 186,000 or something, wasn't it? I think it was
something like that. Yeah, it's 186,282 in miles. But you see, it wasn't that accurate in the 70s. So what I'm saying is, if I didn't have the speed of light perfectly accurate, I wouldn't know that the frequency of the capstone base is 5151, which means the builder knew that because that's the same number as the slope angle. And Stonehenge, it sits at 51 degrees and 1 minute north latitude.
That's true.
And most of the crop circles in England are on the 51 degrees and 51 minute line. So I'm going, holy cow. Now, the theory that the Ark of the Covenant was the charge source to generate the frequencies in the pyramid. So there's a lot of qubits out there. And I know what a true qubit is now because in Robert Temple's book, The Great Pyramid Decoded, he shows you the most common measurement in the pyramid is 41.21 Egyptian inches and equals 2 royal cubits. So you take your calculator and you go, okay, if this 41.21 is everywhere in the pyramid, I mean everywhere, the Grand Gallery, I mean, it's everywhere, this measurement. You'll see it all over the place, 2 royal cubits. So you take 41.21 Egyptian inches is 2 cubits. Half of that is a real cubit, which is 20.605 Egyptian inches, is a true cubit. So now God said, make the Ark of the Covenant 2.5 cubits. So if I take 20.605 times 2.5, it's 5151. You see, now that means Moses, being raised by Egyptians, was probably...
had this knowledge.
He had this knowledge of the 5-1 harmonics. And he was probably using it to be in contact with the true ancient Egyptian deities, which were outlawed under the dynasty, I think it's 18th dynasty when Moses was around, under Pharaoh. Pharaoh didn't want anybody worshiping the old gods, Anubis or any of them, Isis, Osiris, any of them. It was banned. So what Moses had to do was steal the ark, because the ark was his communication device to, let's say, the gods, because we know that the Nephilim, that means many gods in the Old Testament, and that we can't verify for certain that Moses was only in touch with one particular deity. So that's most likely what was really going on. Yeah, Moses is 18th dynasty under Pharaoh. So that at that time, it became illegal also, the knowledge about the star system of Sirius and the ancient Egyptian deities was also illegal. And that's why the keepers of the pre-dynastic knowledge about Sirius left Egypt and brought it to Mali, Northwest Africa. So you read Robert Temple's book, the Sirius Mystery, you learn all about that. Now, Robert Temple also wrote a book on the Sphinx, and he proves that the head of the Sphinx, which is now the face of the Pharaoh, it was originally Anubis, the god of the underworld, the god who takes the deceased souls to distant star systems like Sirius to live their life with the gods and the goddesses.
Which would explain why the there's a weird size difference between the head and the body. I was just saying, in response to what you were just saying, that might explain the size difference between the head and the body of the Sphinx house is completely out of ratio.
Yeah, that's what Robert Temple, I have the book and I've read it. It's very clear it's the body of a dog. And that Sirius is known as the dog star, which is why Sirius XM Radio has the little dog star as their logo. And the keepers of that knowledge moved to Mali, Northwest Africa, because the pharaohs banned it. They didn't want anyone worshiping the old gods. So Moses lived in a time when the Ark of the Covenant and the pyramids probably still worked, and he's probably the only one who knew how to use and tune the pyramid, because he was trained in the ancient arts of this communication. And it's likely he took the Ark, and the reason the Jews were persecuted and followed by Pharaoh's armies is not to get the slaves back. They wanted the ark back because it belonged to Egypt. But Moses is the only one who knew how to use it. This is what, you see, if the ark is truly 51 degrees and 51 minutes, 51 Egyptian inches long, 51.51 Egyptians long, and the pyramid slope angle when it was finished, it's a known fact, was 51 degrees and 51 minutes, and that the frequency of the capstone is 5.151 megahertz square, you see, it unifies them all. Moses' ark belongs to the pyramid. And his god is probably deeply tied to ancient Egypt. And it may not even be the correct name in the translations from the Hebrew back into English. You know, it may simply be all wrong. So we don't really know. What Anubis showed me in that direct experience was that there was a disaster coming that was very sudden. They had to leave. They turned on the pyramid vortex generators, and it allowed them to teleport a great number of people off the planet. And he said many people did die because, and many people did die because there was not enough time to get them off planet. And we know from also Graham Hancock studies that something did happen around 10,000 years ago that would have been very sudden that ended life for a great portion of humans on the Earth. And the Great Pyramid is definitely no tomb to any pharaoh. That is just an absolute fable that it was, because the builder would have known the speed of light. And you would have to, the only way to know the speed of light is you would have to be an advanced civilization, at least as advanced as we are today. And the math would not lie. There's no way. I mean, I resolved the speed of light right down to Egyptian inches, and I took the speed of light divided by the circuit around the capstone base, and it's 5151. I did it over and over again to make sure. There's no question the math is right. And that is an impossibility, because that number is so sacred, the 51. You have to understand the meaning of why Area 51 got its name, Area 51. Now, I further went into what is known as the Gospel of the Egyptians, which is an ancient Christian manuscript, because Jesus was raised in Egypt, just like Moses. He taught his students to meditate to these tones, these different tones that would activate their light body. Now, I believe I have found the entire music scale that was inside of the pyramid math. And I know I found it because there's a video on Vimeo. If you go to Vimeo and you search the lost scale, you'll see a black icon there with this kind of diamond-like thing. That's my short video. And I compare the tones of our music scale, which if you stack them in a tone generator, all 12 tones of the chromatic scale, or just the 7, A, B, C, D, F, G, they all distort. If you go to the solfeggio scale, it also distorts.
What
But
hertz
the,
is this in?
what's that?
What hertz would this be in? This scale would have been
Well,
432?
I decoded the frequencies in hertz, and I the tones, when you hear them at the end of the video, they're perfect. They don't distort at all. There's 10 tones. It's a 10-tone scale. In the Book of Psalms in the Bible, there is a 10-string lyre or harp, right? Well, now this is really interesting, because the first lyre in the Greek musical system was known as the kithara. And the Greeks placed a number value for every word and letter in their language. So in the Greek alphabet, every letter, alpha through gamma, are all numbered. And the number for kithara is 5-1. And kithara is the early harp. So it means it's most likely Pythagoras knew the 515.1C scale. And so I decoded all the tones, because I took the base of the pyramid and went all the way up, and I found the music scale that Jesus taught to activate the light body. And I now have on my website an online course of 26 lessons, which teaches you how to meditate to, you see, there's 10 bass tones, but there's 12 octaves. So there's 120 tones that you spend 6 months meditating to turn on your light body. And people, 220 people just did my course, and many of them are having incredible light body experiences and bliss experiences and seeing visions in their third eye of light beings doing these tones of this perfect ancient lost music scale, which we now call the scale of life. So it's all based on the same numbers. And these numbers exist everywhere. Why is Stonehenge sitting at 51 degrees and 1 minute north latitude? Why is the ark truly 51.51 Egyptian inches long? You know, why 5-1 is the meaning of the kithara? See, kithara became guitara, which became sitara in India. So it means 5-1. It means that the 515.1 is the true seat. It's where it should be. And to say that Pythagoras gave us this modern music scale is an absolute mistake, because the Greeks would not have given us C at 528 or wherever we have it now. I don't have it right in front of me. And it's not just a matter of adjusting C. Every one of the tones in our music scale is off. And so is solfeggio. You got to see the lost scale video. And for people who want to take the course, it takes you 6 months to do it. You just go to my website at davidserena.net and go to Quantum Regenesis. It's all the information is right there.
Did anything come up in the hertz range of 432?
No, it's actually shockingly 414.1.
414.1.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
See, 432 is a bit of a misnomer. I know the people who discovered it. I'm not going to name them because it's pretty good research. So you take the speed of light. Here's what they do. One of their arguments is you take the speed of light and you calculate the square root of the speed of light. So you take the square root of 186, 282, and you get 186, 282 is 431.603985153.05. See, it's not 432, it's 431.6. But see, that doesn't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. Because if I take the speed of light in metric, it doesn't come to 431.6. The only numbers in math that are universal are frequency. You see, if I take the circumference of the Earth and I divide it into the speed of light in standard feet and inches, and then I do it again in metric, it's the same number accurate to 3 decimal points. So frequency, as long as your resolution of measurement is ultra fine, the accuracy in decimal points increases in different counting systems. So frequency is universal. It's a universal truth. Mm-hmm. If I were an extraterrestrial and I didn't use feet and inches, my frequency would always be the same. Now, if their second was longer or shorter, I would have a different number, but the actual frequency would not change. The tonal value of the oscillations per second in any term of seconds will always be the same. So what that means is frequency is a intergalactic universal language. Mm-hmm. Now, ratio is the same as frequency. See, if I divide 10 centimeters by 9 centimeters, it's a ratio of 1 to 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, right? Which is known as an Archimedean infinity. Now, if I change the centimeters to inches, it's still a ratio of 1 to 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So it means that squaring the speed of light and giving you 431.6, which they rounded off to 432, which is not correct, is meaningless because a unit of measure is not universal. Only frequency and ratio are universal. So that's why 432 mathematically has no value, because it's all based on the 6-base math that we use today. We use metric 10-base and we use 6-base, right? Yep. So you get 360 degrees in a circle is 6 times 6 is 36, right? So that's, and then you have 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. You see, that's all 6-base math, which is all based on 360 days a year plus 5 days, right? So it's all based on a 360 degree circle. But see, those are units of measure, and units of measure don't mean anything in the universe, but frequency does. It's always the same. It's a universal language. And so 432 doesn't show up anywhere in the frequency of the Earth or anything like that. So I really argue that the 432 is, first of all, it's the square root of the speed of light is not 432. It's 431.6039851. So, but that still doesn't matter because it's only a unit of measure. And sound is frequency, right? So, and electromagnetic waves are frequency. So you'd have to find a 432 somewhere in a frequency in nature. And the frequency of the sun is definitely not 432. It's 0.00 something. I have the exact number for the frequency of the equator of the sun. And when you get near the poles, the frequencies get much higher. So the people who were doing the 432ism were doing it all based on units of measure, and that is just not a universal truth. See, I could calculate the frequency of the capstone of the Great Pyramid using metric or standard inches, and I'm going to get the same number.
Get the
You
exact same thing, and that would be
get
five one five
800,
one.
551 megahertz square, whether I do it in inches or I do it in centimeters, I'm still going to get the same number. See,
That's
that's why,
fascinating.
see, and I've done it. I've done the math. As long as you're using, like, see, if I use 32nds of an inch, see, a centimeter is like smaller than an eighth of an inch, right?
Yeah.
So you got 10 centimeters per meter, and you have 10 millimeters per centimeter. So it's all 10 base. It's tens and tens and tens. And those 10 factors get really ultra fine. But with inches, you got to go down to 32nds and then 64ths, right? But you'll still get the same number as long as you break the speed of light down to how many 64ths of an inch are there in the speed of light. And then you, because the smaller your wavelength, when you're calculating frequencies on crystals, which are very small in your computers, your math has to be ultra fine. And they tend to use metric because it's finer resolution. But if I resolve six base math down to 160, you know, tiny, tiny fractions of an inch, as long as my fractions are really tiny,
You
I'm
can
gonna
get it
get the same
precise.
number. And that's why frequency, like when you see the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Spielberg, the ETs were communicating through sound. They gave us tones and they gave us coordinates on the earth, and they communicated when they landed. It was this big musical frequency communication going back and forth. You see, Spielberg was really brilliant because that's the language they would use. And in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, she's saying that the ETs would use math would be the universal language. But inside of math, it's not measurement that's universal. It's only frequency and ratio that are universal. There's one more form of math that's more advanced that also remains universal. And that would be something like binary. And so there's no question that there's nothing in 432 that is universal. It may be a nice sound, but I can bet that the whole theory behind it is has no real meaning because it's a unit of measure. It's not an actual. Now, if you find it in nature, so you got to find it in nature. You know, you can find phi in nature, the golden ratio in nature. And here's another thing about 5151. You take pi, 3.14, you know, do the long form, which is the you take the diameter of the circle times pi to get the distance around a circle. Now take pi times 0.5151 and you get the golden ratio, 1.618. So 5151 is part of the trinity of the three most sacred numbers in existence.
It's
So
trippy
the five
stuff,
one,
yeah.
see that's amazing. Yeah, you take pi, and here I have long form pi in my calculator, times 0.5151, which is the 5151, you get 1.618234. So it's you know, even pi, today's pi is slowly creeping towards Egyptian pi. Egyptian pi is 22 divided by 7. And our pi will eventually reach Egyptian pi. When I'm calculating the frequencies, see, the bigger a circle gets, the more they have to fudge pi, 3.14, you know. So it's constantly being fudged because it gets more and more accurate when you're resolving bigger and bigger circles, which is why you can't use pi r squared to square a circle. But with that, I really think there's so much proof for the 5151. And when you hear these tones in the Lost Scale video on Vimeo, it's going to blow your mind how perfect the Egyptian tones are. And I've got people, you know, emailing me because I give out all the numbers. I have an ebook on my website that gives out all the numbers. There's 360 tones in the Lost Egyptian scale. Just as there are 360 degrees in a circle, there are actually 360 tones that the human ear can hear. So ultimately, there are more octaves than there's more octaves than that, but the human ear can hear 360 tones. And that is phenomenal. Phenomenal that this scale has that many tones in it that you can hear. So we're spending 3 years, each year we do 120 tones to switch on the light body inside of people, because that's what Jesus taught in the Gospel of the Egyptians. He taught his students to tone these tones to activate the what is known as the chrism. You see, in mystic Christianity and in Gnostic Christianity, the baptism is only an initiation. It doesn't guarantee any kind of salvation. You need the chrisms. And there are multiple chrisms, which are activations of the light body to get true freedom and liberation. And Jesus was also a student of ancient Egypt because he was raised in Egypt. And the Coptic Christians have records of his whole childhood and his teen years being in Egypt. So like Moses, he was trained in these ancient scales.
He had this knowledge, the same stuff Moses was working with.
The same stuff that Moses and the same stuff that Pythagoras and Archimedes and the ancient Greeks were studiers of the ancient Egyptian, you know, mathematical systems, which is why we have phi and pi and all of it. It's because it all goes back to ancient Egypt.
Now that's absolutely fantastic. And out of the interviews I've heard you do before and other things, I haven't heard you go into this and I'm grateful for what you've brought to my attention, and I'm sure the listeners and viewers are too. We'll wrap it up in a minute, but you've got the website, davidsarita.net. Just wanted to ask you a question about the pendants. What's to go with the Lightstream Tech pendants? These things are absolutely stunning and beautiful. There's so many different types. There's the Trinity and Trillion and Vortex and Sunray and Flower of Life ones. How do these things work? Is it just wearing them, or what's to go with them?
Well, see, what happens is crystals have these little semiconductor vortex holes in them, and these unbound electrons bubble up to the surface of crystals, which is why they're running your computers and your cell phones and everything. And what I found with the body in the early days is if I walked around barefoot with a voltmeter and I picked up some crystal, I could see a slight change in the voltage in the body. And so then I found a way to program information, harmonic information and frequencies in the crystal lattice. And I found a way to open up a crystal so that it could receive an imprint in a very highly compressed magnetic field. And I programmed them with the logos, the recording that NASA made of the sound of our sun. But I don't use sound waves. I'm not doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm now able to custom program crystals with the Palladian frequencies or Vega or Sirius or pyramid frequencies. So a lot of people buy our pendants and they really feel them. Like they put it on and they say it changed their whole life. There are people that have had reduced pain. They've had healings. They've had when a couple buys them, they're noticing amazing telepathy between them, mm-hmm. because that's exactly how telecommunications work, that we're using crystals, right? So when any two crystals are tuned to the same frequency and two people wear them, you're going to have increased telepathy between those people. But also we had people at trade shows, you know, when I would lecture at UFO conferences and other conferences, they'd run down to the aura camera booth and they would get their aura taken, and then they put the pendant on and get their aura taken, and there was a dramatic improvement in their aura.
Really?
And I've had customers who, like, they don't believe you. They think you're faking it. So what they do is they buy a pendant. I had this guy in New York, and he goes to the aura camera place in New York, gets his aura done, and then he puts the pendant on, waits a few minutes, and gets his aura done, and he goes, "Oh, my God, it's better." He goes, "You're telling the truth." And I said, "Of course, because these are harmonically treated crystals." So we can also, like, if people don't like our designs and they find them too big, They can send in their diamond earrings. They can send in crystal earrings. They can send in rings and wedding bands. And I can program anything, gold, silver, copper, or crystal. Anything with that's gem or diamond works better than just a conductive material like a metal. But we custom treat other people's jewelry, and we have our own stuff there at davidsrita.net. So they're beautiful pieces. They're way more stunning in person than you can see in the picture.
Yeah, they look awesome. They look absolutely awesome.
And it's amazing how many people in Australia are wearing them. I mean, they're handmade in Sedona, and a lot of the designs are my own. Like, I personally designed the Trillion, and the Trinity design was mine and the Trillion. And there are some other people that help me with some of the other designs, but then they get shipped to me, and then they get programmed in my technology here in Nelson, British Columbia, and then I ship them out from here. But I, at any given time, I have 80 or so pendants here in stock. So if anybody wants them, you know, they can just go to the website, or they can write me at davidsrita@hotmail.com if they have any further questions.
Absolutely fantastic. One thing I'd like to ask you, I was taken aback by a Facebook post you did about, you know, almost a day ago. And I just wanted to ask how this came. Like, you said here, I was pulsing very specific, special frequencies last night through my mantra transmitter during meditation. These frequencies get me really high naturally, which we'll talk about the bliss state, blissed out state, which totally resonates with me. You said, early morning I'm dreaming that I'm opened a portal, and Marilyn Monroe is talking to me through the portal. What she's saying is so advanced. I would need to record it. She's deeply concerned with how to repair the wounds to Mother Earth, which I can deeply relate to also at the moment. She knows how it can be done with my technology. This is the fourth contact I've had with Marilyn Monroe over the years. I had no conversations about her since the last time I saw her, telling me about her death years back. So I know I'm not imagining this. She told me this last night. I just have to say her name and she can hear me. I have an open line to her. How did this happen? Like, was this absolutely taking you aback? Like, as you've said, you've had a few communications with her, but this, when this happened, it was just so vivid, so real.
You know, I hadn't even watched Marilyn Monroe films. I can't say I was ever obsessed with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this experience in Sedona when I had first started this technology, and I had this dream of her death. And in her death, there were two Marilyn Monroes. There was her astral body, which was really blissed out and laughing in the light. There was all this light. And then there was her physical body, which was crying on the floor. And she told me that there was an investigation done into her death that was going to be published, and someone stopped it from being published. And she gave me the year of that investigation. And I researched the year of the investigation, and sure enough, there was a investigation into her death that was stopped by some very powerful people in government from ever coming out. And she showed me a filing cabinet where this file was placed. She told me I could have called someone and saved my life, but she said these people wanted me dead. It wouldn't matter if I saved my life, they would come and do it again. And they were so serious about killing her, and it took her quite some time to die. And she said in her spirit she was laughing and crying with so much love. And I saw her house. I was inside her house, and I saw her body on the floor, and it was so incredible. Like, I was reliving it. And that was the first experience I had with her. And then I went to her gravesite in Westwood with a really good psychic who was living there. And we sat there at her gravesite, and I said, you know, I'm really astounded. How did I pull Marilyn Monroe out of the rabbit's hat? Like, why her? She wasn't on my mind. Then I decided to watch some of her older movies, and I watched this one that she did with horses, and it made me cry my eyes out, because this woman was one hell of an actress. I mean, she was so emotional in this movie and so beautifully connected to nature and the animals and the horses. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't know Marilyn Monroe wasn't, you know, some just beauty queen. This woman could act better than most actresses today. And she could pull emotions out of me that I couldn't even believe a Marilyn Monroe could do this. And I just fell in love with her emotions. So she appeared to me again in Sedona, and she was really, really clear about that Kennedy gave her information that I would have been interested in, and but she didn't say it was about Roswell, but I knew it was. I knew that John F. Kennedy had given her information that she wasn't supposed to know. And I said, well, would they kill you over that? Why did they really want you dead? And that was hard to get the answer out of her. So why they wanted her dead, because she said it was more than one reason. She just knew way too much because of her relationship to the president. Mm-hmm. And she had the ability to really open some doors to the public that would be too shocking for the American people. Now, there's this recent confession of the man who physically killed her. And I saw her killers in the dream, and they were definitely hired. And this recent confession claims, you know, the CIA would tell the killer that Marilyn Monroe has to be killed because she's a danger to the country, and they'll just kill her. Now, they can even lie to the killer about the motive. It doesn't, the killer doesn't know anything. They're just a hired person. But what she showed me is, I could have saved my life, David. I could have saved my life. And I just didn't want to save my life because she was so afraid she would have to live her life in fear, because these people went all the way up to the government. They definitely went to the level of CIA. Now, I hadn't thought of Marilyn Monroe for ages, and it was just two nights ago. I'm doing very special frequencies through the mantra, and I'm taking the frequency of Earth and I'm blending it to another frequency. And I'm getting so high. I mean, I meditate all the time and I get into very serious bliss states. But this bliss was outrageous. I mean, it was incredible. And I was telling my wife, oh my God, you know, I just love this state that I'm going into. And all of a sudden, there's Marilyn Monroe in my dream. And I can see the vortex that the mantra has opened up. And she's saying, hi, David, it's me, it's Marilyn. And I'm here, and you now have a direct line to me. You can just ask me anything. And I was just in shock going, oh my God. And she's telling me that she's literally living in a higher dimension of Earth. Now, I went through 14 years after a blinding apparition that where Christ appeared to me in 1994. And after Christ appeared to me in this blazing like a thousand suns.
Do again, just for a second there, you're going into when Christ appeared to you like a thousand blazing suns, and I think around there it just dropped out. But if you
with the advent of my experiences with Christ, I had the instant ability within days to see spirits as clear as regular humans. They're not faint and whispery. Mm-hmm. They are perfectly clear, and I've seen hundreds. And I know that there's another dimension of Earth that Jesus talked about in the Gospel of Thomas. Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is rolled out like a scroll in front of you right here on Earth. You just don't see it. Mm-hmm. And also Dante said in his visions, where he went through the nine levels of heaven, that the first heaven is the paradise Earth, which is the Paradiso that Dante wrote. That there is a first level of heaven right on top of Earth interdimensionally. And I knew a lot of the spirits I was seeing were luminous and living in the paradise Earth. And Marilyn was telling me two nights ago that the way to heal the Earth is to build large versions of my transmitters, my vortex transmitters, the mantras, and pull in the higher frequency Earth down into transmitting it into the regular frequency of Earth. And she said it will bring balance to nature and, you know, all the dying creatures in the ocean and the, you know, the waters. But it's going to have to happen on a mass scale. And I was really shocked that she knew this. I mean, how do you know this? I mean, we know her as this beautiful actress. But once they're living in the paradise Earth, which is a higher frequency Earth, they're learning and learning and learning things that we don't learn on Earth. You know, a lot of what we learn here in school is pretty much a waste of time, in my opinion. I mean, a lot of it's good. There's a lot of good stuff we learn in school. But there's a lot, especially spiritually and with consciousness, that we're not, it's only people like you and I and people listening to your show and shows like this that are really interested in consciousness. So what Marilyn is very awake now. She's very awake. She was all, if you really watch her movies, you'll see how passionate this woman was about animal rights and about humanity and you know, the state of being, and why she was so interested in John F. Kennedy is not simply just because she thought he was a handsome man. It's because she was really interested in changing the world.
And fascinating stuff.
She knew if she could get the ear of the president that she could put some of her ideas into his ear through the power of her, you know, sensuality and really bring some changes. And there were people in the government that did not want her relationship with him to continue. And there may have been a possibility, according to this psychic that I know, when we were at her grave, that she was actually pregnant and with the president's child, and that would have been a motive for somebody in the Kennedy family, not JFK himself, but somebody who wanted her dead. Now, she didn't tell me that in person. Now, another time she appeared to me in Sedona, she showed me her whole house was bugged, and there were detectors everywhere in her house, and it was starting to make her paranoid, and it started to make her take more of the drugs that she was taking. She was definitely on barbiturates and things she was doing, going to parties and getting, but she was getting more drugged out because she was really paranoid. She lived in a state of paranoia because she, when she was alive, she found the bugs, and everywhere she went, she was bugged.
Sort of a reality check to her how serious the situation was.
Yeah. And she showed me that very clearly, you know, where they placed them and, you know, the phone everywhere. So that's why she didn't save her life. There was, the killers made sure she had enough drugs in her to kill her, but they didn't prevent her at a certain point. And she looked dead at a certain point because she was so, you know, laid flat on the ground. But, there was a time when she could have saved her life, but then there was a time when it was too late.
And like you said, they were going to get her either way. They weren't going to stop
at
that.
Yeah, I've never talked about this before on any radio show about those contacts. And again, it's the further thing from my mind when I went to sleep the other night. So you can't imagine this stuff. You're not imagining it in your dream. It's very real. I'm using technology to open a portal, and I'm getting contact from the other side from a surprise person. Hi, David. It's Marilyn.
Yeah. I know what it's like, mate. It's just tripped out. You can't make this up. So, you know.
No, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I've had such accurate information given to me from the other side that translates into very verifiable data on this side. And that's, you know, another subject, another time.
Look, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been awesome. We've never spoken. We spoke for about a minute before we started the show, and you hadn't come across my stuff, and I hadn't heard about your contacts. So for my peace of mind, I've had some, you know, clarity and confirmation on other levels, because you still, you know, in the human body computer, you do go on my nuts sometimes, but it's been great having you on. Thank you for sharing the stuff that you've shared.
Yeah, can you send me a link to your book and your experiences with the Palladians? I'd really like to know.
I will do that for sure, and I'll send you a link to these straight away on Facebook as soon as it's up. But yeah, there's three documentaries out, and I've got seven books out, but I'll send you a link to the latest book, which seems to be the main selling one, specifically about the contacts and the information. It was the first channeled book I've done. The other one's just going to completely the contacts, but yeah, have a bit of a browse and just see with what resonates. Like you know, you just got to go with what resonates, and that's where you sort of guided from a higher level.
No, I really believe a lot of us, for some reason, the Pleiades is, you know, there. If you read the Rig Veda, which is the oldest of the ancient Indian Vedas, there is a Pleiadian deity named Kritika, who appeared and taught humans from Pleiades star system. So, I mean, the Rig Veda has it. I mean, the Mayans have it. There's something about that star system. They've been connected to us for a very long time.
Definitely. No, I agree. And people have just got to do the research to see that as well. So But again, thank you, David. I'll send you through the link later on, and thank you for being on the show.
Okay, have a good night.
Cheers, mate. Stay in contact.